music and movie fans. This is Sachin, your host on Sachin on Cinema and Sound. And I'm joined here today by my father.
Hi everyone, this is Mike.
So today we're reviewing what I think is one of the most interesting and just wild movies ever made, which is Casino Royale, but the 1967 version. So Casino Royale has like really, it was the very first James Bond book written by Ian Fleming. And that's a really, really interesting, I guess, history in being adapted for cinemas. The very first version was in 1954, when it was, like, adapted for an hour of television, which was, like, part of a show, an anthology series called Climax Mystery Theater, or something like that. And then, of course, the version we are reviewing today is the second screen adaptation, or the very first theatrical version from 1967. So, even though this book, Casino Royale, was the very first Bond book ever written in 1953 by Ian Fleming, Dr. No, which was the sixth book, was the very first movie starring Sean Connery in 1962. And that's because of a very complicated history of the James Bond copyright. So, the Bond series, as we know it, is produced by Eon Productions. And they received the rights to the books, to all the books, or nearly all the books, in like the early 60s. Except one of the big exceptions was this book, Casino Royale, because the rights to that book were already sold to a producer, Charles K. Feldman. So, as a result, this is one of two James Bond movies that is kind of viewed as unofficial because it wasn't made under the same series as the famous Sean Connery and, like, eventually Roger Moore films.
So, Sutton, Feldman had a bit of an issue, didn't he? Because he acquired the rights to Casino Royale, but this other series started in 1962 and was well established by 1967. By the time he decided to go ahead and do this film. So what does he do? Does he go ahead and create another Bond film like the other Bond films, but a competing Bond film? Or does he take it in a different direction?
So at first he actually did, I think they were really considering just having like a serious take on it and maybe possibly branching off into their own series. In fact, they actually approached Sean Connery to star in this one, but he said something like, only for $1 million.
He had a Scottish accent when he said it, though.
Yeah. I think he actually seriously would have done it for $1 million, but I guess that was too much for them at the time. I think they eventually got Peter Sellers as, like, the main one. This movie, I think, as you saw in the trailer, has multiple Bonds, which it gets complicated, but we'll see it. So Peter Sellers was the main one they approached, and apparently his salary actually was $1 million, so I don't know why they didn't just stick with Sean, but either way, because they couldn't get Sean, they decided that they could have had like an unfavorable comparison to the official Bond films, so then they kind of went into the direction of doing a Bond parody. And what's really interesting is I've said that this was one of two unofficial Bond movies, but the second unofficial Bond movie is Never Say Never Again, which actually does have Sean Connery in it, and that movie is also because was also made because of copyright issues. It was the second screen adaptation of the novel Thunderball. So, and that movie was very much a straight Bond film. So it's really interesting how very different these two unofficial Bond films are.
It'll be interesting to watch this. This is a parody then of the Bond series, based on or inspired by an actual Bond novel written by Ian Fleming, but taken in a very, very different direction with people like Peter Sellers and Woody Allen and a very interesting cast.
It's a really interesting cast, including like Orson Welles. We just saw the trailer to get some, I guess, context, and we saw from that how it seemed like their main promotional point was really hammering in like their like all-star cast list. One of them was Gavin Newman, who ironically was actually Ian Fleming's first choice to be the actor who played James Bond, although Fleming died 3 years before this movie was made, and I think if he had lived long enough, I don't think this was exactly what he intended for, like Gavin Newman were to play James Bond, but right now I'm just laying out the context. I've seen the movie before a while ago, and I know you haven't seen it yet. So some things to look out for is. Well, one of the things he asked me was if the film did well. So this movie is kind of one of those movies that is like really well known for having a bit of a troubled production that really went into overshoots, and it's been kind of compared to Cleopatra, which was a movie that like had a lot of budget problems and just kept running into overshoots. This movie originally had a budget of $6 million, which was already at the time seen as quite a like a fairly large budget, but by the time the movie ended, the production ended, the budget had doubled to $12 million. And this movie was actually released in the same year as an official James Bond movie, which was You Only Live Twice. That movie had a budget of $9.5 million. So the spoof was more expensive to make than the actual Bond movie from the same year.
Which is hard to imagine. Doesn't require all those special effects, you would think. But we'll see how it looks on screen.
Yeah, and then I think just a couple other things are a couple of this movie stars are Orson Welles and Peter Sellers, who they do have a couple scenes together, but they actually hated each other in like very soon after having met on the set, and maybe I'll like dive more into that later. But basically, even though they share a couple scenes, very rarely were they actually like on the set at the same time. So they would like film like Peter Sellers, like the camera of Peter Sellers' side of the room, and then. And then he would walk off, and then they would get Orson Welles on the left side of the room, and then film like him, even though supposedly they're like on opposite sides of the table. I think something else.
Are you saying that they didn't even want to be in the same room together for a
Exactly.
shoot? Oh my
Yeah,
gosh.
there were like maybe two shots, in the movie with them both in the same shot, even though they have like a couple scenes with them, supposedly in close proximity. And then Peter Sellers, I guess he was, I guess, just very problematic during the production. It's unclear whether he just walked off at one point or was fired, but either way, he was no longer attached to this. But some like by before production ended, so of course he was Peter Sellers, so they weren't gonna like recast him or anything. They tried to salvage as much of his footage as they could and keep it in the film, but there are, I guess, there's like one very like noticeably large gap in continuity where you can tell that they should have like filmed like another sequence with him, but so it's like, okay, well, I guess this supposedly happened even though we didn't see it. Yeah, a bit of a warning for you who are watching for the first time, and I guess one other thing is that this is actually an Oscar-nominated film. One of the songs, "The Look of Love," received an Oscar nomination for, I think, Best Original Song for like a visual work. Yeah, overall, all this movie actually has, I feel, a very good soundtrack. So.
Well, it has something going for it then.
Yeah.
All right.
Yep,
Look forward to seeing it.
let's dive into it. And we are back. This was probably either my second or third time watching this movie. Well, this was your first. And Of course, I think the first reaction that is expected was stunned.
My first reaction was just, wow. And that is kind of my third, fourth, and fifth reaction. It's just, I'm not quite sure what I just saw.
Yeah, the movie is definitely like sensory overload. It could have one. I said that it had five directors who were all like the very first scenes with the with like where they MI6 tried to get Bond out of retirement to face off against Mersch. Those were directed by John Huston, who also played M. So each director there were actually six directors, but one of them for some reason didn't want to be credited. Probably didn't.
Shocking.
Yeah. So I guess it could be just too many chefs in the kitchen. They were all filming like their separate segments and weren't really aware of what the other four were working on. I think another problem was Peter Sellers, who was very problematic during this movie. I think pretty egotistical. There's so many ways I can like branch off and like I guess one story I'll start with is how his relationship with Orson Welles was, which I already said during the pre-show. They both hated each other nearly instantly. So on the set, he was bragging to his co-stars about how he and Princess Margaret knew each other. And she was actually going to visit the set. And then when she finally arrived on the set, she walked right by past Peter Sellers and then went straight to Orson Welles. And Peter Sellers felt really humiliated by this. So as a result, he refused to work with Orson Welles, even though they share a couple scenes together. And as I said, there were only a couple shots where they're actually in the same frame at the same time. And again, they're supposedly playing baccarat at the same against each other and are on other ends of the same table. And in return, Orson Welles said that he refused to work with quote unquote that amateur, referring to Peter Sellers. Peter Sellers also insisted that he have top billing over everyone else in the movie, which included Orson Welles, and he actually somehow succeeded. He does have top billing in this movie. Another thing that he did was that he took the script of his scenes to a professional writer named Cary Southern, and had Cary Southern rewrite specifically his dialogue, just his character's dialogue and no one else's. So that he could outshine Woody Allen and Orson Welles in the movie. Also, do you remember that scene when he is encountered by Miss Goodthighs and then fires the gun but misses at her?
I don't remember him shooting the gun. It was one of maybe thousands of rounds of ammunition that went off during the
Yeah.
course of this film, so I don't remember that one specifically.
Okay, well. He well he's like he's not expecting anyone, and then Miss Goodthighs, when she first a character who like when she first appears, his character Evelyn Tremble kind of like jumps and like instinctively fires the gun but misses her, and then as like some practical joke, the gun was really filled with blanks. He fired it directly in the actress's face, and then her face was covered in gunpowder and was like bleeding in the places where I guess the shards went, and that's something that would definitely get like
Wow.
a modern gay star like in serious legal trouble,
Yeah,
but.
and that actress, by the way, was credited in this film as Jackie Bisset, later becoming known as Jacqueline Bisset, who became a very prominent, well-known actress in films like The Deep.
Interesting, I did not know that. And yeah, at the time though, it was I think Peter Sellers' attitude was just kind of shrugged off tripped off as like movie star drama.
And there's plenty of opportunity for movie star drama in this film because this had a surprisingly stellar cast.
Yeah, I don't know how this many, I guess, celebrities agreed to have themselves treated to this movie. I
And
guess,
a lot of
yeah.
celebrities that are known for very serious films, stepping into a slapstick parody.
Yeah, what's really interesting about that is that Peter Sellers, even though he was well known as a comedic actor, I was actually upset by the decision to have this a parody movie, and he wanted to play the part of Bond straight. So I think you, and I think that is kind of evident by the fact that his scenes are the ones that are closest to the original novel, with him playing Baccarat against Lechiffre and getting into like how he was the financial manager Lechiffre is of Smirsch, and then he had to play Baccarat to win back a lot of the organization's money that he had lost. Another problem with, I think one final problem with Peter Sellers was that he, when a film director, one of the five or six, actually confronted him about his personality on set, Peter Sellers punched him in the face. So, needless to say, all this was really why he, Peter Sellers, it's unclear, he either walked off the movie prematurely, because already up to that point, he had sometimes just wouldn't show up. He would show up really late on certain days, or just wouldn't show up at all. Or he was either fired.
It sounds like there was more drama behind the cameras than there were in front of the cameras for this movie.
Yeah. this as I also said that this movie has had a lot of comparisons to Cleopatra. Its budget had basically doubled by the time the movie was over, the production of the movie was over, and the shooting schedule it just kept getting delayed more and more. I think the budget is actually evident in the final film though, because it does have a very lavish production to it. The a lot of, it has a really wide variety of sets that are really large and exquisitely detailed. And of course, the cast I'm sure had to have really big salaries to have people like Orson Welles and John Huston in it. I also mentioned how one of the very few things that is what actually considered really good about this movie is the scoring by I think Burt Bacharach.
Heard Bacharach.
Yeah, and yeah, this I feel like this movie lacks a lot of cohesion, and it's hard to tell with certain scenes what the tone is supposed to be, if it's supposed to be like tense or serious or funny. And of course that could potentially make it a very hard movie to write a score for, but it's probably one of the most memorable film scores that I've heard. They're really great, like 60s themed jazzy inspired tunes. That really helped to add to this movie's energy. And of course it has the look of love in it, which was resulted in this being a Oscar nominated movie, which is rather ironic. And of course another interesting member of the cast is David Niven, who I say interesting because he actually was Ian Fleming's first choice to play Bond, and Ian Fleming was initially kind of turned off by Sean Connery. Although when he like visited the set of Dr. No a few times, he warmed up to him. Ian Fleming actually sent for the first edition of Casino Royale when it was first published to David Niven, I guess, so that he could hopefully like turn the actor like into the idea of like eventually playing the role. And then in one of the novels, You Only Live Twice, the Bond girl in that novel actually mentions that she was once romantically involved with the Hollywood actor. So needless to say, it's really interesting that Ian Fleming's wish was eventually made true in this movie, but I'm still guessing that Fleming was probably rolling in his grave when this movie was released, because this was not at all what he would have wanted or expected from his characters. Of course, we've also mentioned Orson Welles, and I told you, although I forgot to mention this in the pre-show, that one of the conditions for them to get Orson Welles was that Orson Welles said that he would do it if they agreed to let him do magic tricks in the movie, and he even worked that into his contract. So I feel like I kind of get the impression that he was as egotistical as Peter Sellers was, which probably explains why they didn't get along that well. And also, I get if this was like Orson Welles' ego that he wanted to do this, but Orson Welles is, of course, a very, like, well-established and famous film director and writer and producer, so I'm kind of surprised that he didn't, like, think about this film narratively and what his magic tricks would add to the narrative. It doesn't add anything to the movie.
It's not easy to work in magic tricks in the middle of a game of Baccarat in a casino. It makes no sense whatsoever. You're not going to have a woman lie down on the Baccarat table during a game so that you can levitate her. This shows in their efforts to indulge the Hollywood talent how the film went astray.
Yeah, I think it also shows that way too many cooks in the kitchen with people who shouldn't even be cooks suddenly just having their influence creeping into the movie, like Peter Sellers and Orson Welles. And actually the reason why the point of a lot of Gavin Nivsen scenes, they were added to encapsulate Peter Sellers scenes once he had walked off the set, and then so that they could still salvage the footage, so they were kind of added as a framing device. Still, despite their best efforts, I think the fact that Peter Sellers left this movie prematurely was definitely not subtle. Towards the end of his scenes, one scene shows him getting into a race car to save, I think, one of the other MI6 agents, Vesper Lind. And then the very next scene suddenly shows him getting tortured by Le Chief. They clearly were not able to film like some kind of car chase where and show him get the character getting captured.
And this was the kind of a film where you know they would have loved to have shown a car race and implement some kind of comedic elements to that.
Yeah, and then it also just spirals downhill after that with suddenly him being like in this like foggy room full of these Scotsmen, and then I can't really go much further without saying spoilers, but like once that scene ends, I feel like you kind of be hopeful that the movie will start to tie things up with the narrative, the main narrative of the Baccarat game ending, and then there only being 20 minutes left, but then they literally have this flying saucer come down and then kidnap Bond's daughter, and then they pick up the movie from there, and it just, yeah, it adds a lot of...
In there, it kind of really devolves into slapstick for the rest of the film in large part. Even though they're in a casino in France, all of a sudden, there's the U.S. cavalry that comes in on horses, and Indians.
Yeah, or Native Americans. And yes. then they also had, I think, policemen from the 1920s, because...
In black and white.
Yeah, black and white, and, like, the stock music that would usually accompany silent films.
So the casino turned into some kind of bizarre portal.
Yeah. The casino was, I guess, a cover for what was really the SMERSH headquarters. It's a lot of times it's really unclear what the film is trying to, like, accomplish or strive for. There's also a long sequence in the middle of it where Joanna Pettit, who plays Bond's daughter, goes to a spy school, but it's actually a place where the chief is selling an art collection. And then one thing that I suspect, given I first saw that, and then I later was confirmed by when I did a little research online, was that, like, that whole sequence, how the sets were really kind of, like, everything looked kind of crooked, and, like, the camera angles were really offbeat, and the sets were just, they were, like, painted in black and white, where that, like, the whole sequence was kind of parodying German expressionist cinema, which was, like, a lot of movies, like, Metropolis and the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which were popular in, like, the 1920s, where they really showed a lot of, centered on, like, a lot of insane characters, which was reflected in, like, the offbeat camera angles and set design. But I don't know why they decided to parody that in this movie, and specifically at that time during the spy school sequences.
I suspect that was lost on the American audience in the late 1960s.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things you were wondering was if this movie actually made money, and before the movie was actually even released, Woody Allen said that the movie, he did not think the movie would earn a single cent. But despite his predictions, this movie was actually a really big success. It won like $40 million, over $40 million in the box office, and was like about the 13th or 12th highest grossing movie of that year. Although, of course, it was outbeaten by the official Bond movie of the year, which was You Only Live Twice. I guess the Bond name was enough to draw people in. And
I'm not sure that we've mentioned much about Woody Allen up to this point, but Woody Allen actually played Jimmy Bond, one of the 007, one of the 00 characters. This is at the height of, I think, Woody Allen's comedic film career, around the time that he did things like Bananas and Sleeper. And he really played the character with that kind of Woody Allen persona, which really brought home the fact that this was kind of a slapstick, comedic parody of the 007 franchise.
And I think I read that Woody Allen, apparently in his autobiography, wrote that this movie was not worth the celluloid that it was printed on. Of course, this movie is, I think, probably the worst reviewed of all the Bond films, official or unofficial. It has 25% on Rotten Tomatoes, but I have not regretted watching this movie. It is, I feel like it has to be seen to be believed. I've never seen a movie like this before, and I doubt if I'll ever see another movie that's really as relentless in its absurdity. And, like, sometimes I, like, really try to, like, study the actors' faces to see if I can, like, find subtle hints of, like, one of them internally panicking, like, oh, I can't believe I'm being subjected to this. But everyone really seems to be engaged in what they are doing, which I think really adds to how absurd this movie turned out to be.
It's certainly worth watching as an artifact of the Bond era. But it is just fascinating to see what an accumulation of talent, when not directed in the right way, can turn out to be a waste of that great talent. And when you have a combination of five directors that didn't necessarily coordinate amongst themselves, and a group of actors that let their egos get in the way, you can see a lot of missed opportunity in here. I mean, certainly you've got one of the great film franchises of all time, and a chance to parody that with an incredible cast. You know, it seems like there was stuff that was left on the table on this one.
I agree. I really wonder how, if this was a movie that could have easily turned out to actually be good. Even the way it turned out, though, is definitely worth watching. I guess one final thing that's kind of interesting is how this movie has Ursula Andress in it, who played the very first Bond girl in the official movie by Union Productions' Dr. No. And in that movie, she was dubbed because I guess her accent was too Swiss. In this movie, though, she actually was able to use her voice. She became a little better at speaking English at this point. So it's also really interesting to see her in kind of still in, like, have her career still be involved with the Bond franchise, but in an entirely different way. So after all that said, I think I would still recommend this movie to people who are interested. Very rarely was I bored during its 130-minute running time. So I really enjoy watching this movie for the second or third time and, yeah, discussing it. And I hope you tune in to our next episode.
Thanks, Seth. That was fun.
And this was Such an On Cinema and Sound.